Hello, conspiracy theorists, conspiracy therapists, and conspiracy realists. This is Zach, and you're listening to the special 9/11 edition of the podcast. Okay, maybe it's not that special in particular, but it's for sure an important one, and one that I put a lot of time and thought into. I'm not going to belabor the intro this time, because I want you to get to the meat. Also, I'm running a little behind on my deadline, so without further ado, let's look at what really happened on 9/11. Why, ultimately, we don't have to draw a perfect bow on every question we have for that day to draw a conclusion, and why Bitcoin was my exit from the rabbit hole. Any questions or feedback on this one? Well, bring it on. Send it to z.adair@bitcoinwell.com. That's z.adair@bitcoinwell.com. Everyone, have a great weekend. And remember, question everything. The rabbit hole has an exit. 25 years of 9/11, a lifetime of psyops, and why I ended up in Bitcoin. In 2008, I was 21. I'd just voted for a man who promised to end the wars, and I decided to spend one weekend reading the official story of 9/11 so I could stop thinking about it. That was 18 years ago. 25 years after the towers fell, we still can't agree on the question. I already disliked Bush. I was very much against the wars, and in November 2008, I let myself be convinced that voting for Obama was how you ended them. The disappointment came later, and it came slowly. More countries bombed, drone strikes dispatched by the hundreds, and that pesky Guantanamo Bay just never getting closed. The 9/11 question and the political disillusionment fed each other, but they didn't arrive as one moment. The question came first. Because that same year, I did the thing you weren't supposed to do. I tried to actually understand the official story of 9/11. Not the movie version, the mechanics. I figured I'd spend a weekend and come out reassured. Instead, I watched Loose Change. Three guys from upstate New York, Dylan Avery, Corey Rowe, Jason Burmis, made it on a laptop for a few thousand dollars, and Vanity Fair called it maybe the first internet blockbuster. It was also wrong about a lot. The Cleveland Airport thing, the voice morphing thing. Later cuts dropped those claims, which, credit to the filmmakers, is more than NIST ever did with its own. But the film didn't convince me of any one theory. It broke the spell that said that questions themselves were off limits. It made me watch Building 7 fall, which I'd never seen on television, then read what the government said about it, then notice the distance between the two. Once you've noticed that distance once, you notice it everywhere. That's the real rabbit hole, not the specific theories, the habit of questioning and looking deeper, and finding the difference between the truth and the claim ever widening. Two rooms, 25 years later. Today, a University of Texas panel in Austin takes up 9/11, what happened, and what it means today, with former NATO ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchinson on the DIAS and a program built around energy security and great power rivalry. In New York, Turning the Tide runs September 10th to the 13th at El Museo de Barrio. Family members, first responders, and researchers, among them Bob McIlvain, whose son Bobby died at the World Trade Center, James Corbett on the money trail, Richard Grove on the underground history, and for Thursday night's opening remarks, Jason Burmis, the guy whose film started all this for me. One room is maintaining the machine 9/11 built. The other is asking whether the story it was built on is even true, the half-life of an official story. You see, psyops have a shelf life. Not because the truth eventually comes out in some dramatic moment. It doesn't, usually. It leaks, it gets declassified on a Tuesday when nobody's watching, and by the time it reaches the public, the people responsible are retired, dead, or on a book tour. March 19th, 1962. The Joint Chiefs and Robert McNamara, a memo titled Operation Northwoods, proposing stage attacks to justify invading Cuba. Their words, quote, "We could blow up a U.S. ship in Guantanamo Bay and blame Cuba." Quote, casualty lists in U.S. newspapers would cause a helpful wave of national indignation. A drone painted as a civilian airliner shot down and blamed on Havana. Kennedy killed it. The documents stayed classified until November 1997, 35 years later. Nobody who wrote it ever answered for it. August 1964, the Pentagon reports a second North Vietnamese attack on U.S. destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. 3 days later, Congress hands Johnson his war. The attack never even happened. NSA historian Robert Hanyuk later found the agency passed along only the signals intelligence that supported the attack and withheld the roughly 90% that contradicted it. His study stayed classified until November 2005. McNamara, on camera in The Fog of War, said, "It didn't happen. 41 years and 58,000 names on a memorial in between." February 2003, Colin Powell holds up a vial at the UN. 18 months later, the government's own Iraq Survey Group reports that there were no stockpiles. Fastest correction on the list, and still not fast enough to stop the war it was built to sell. Do you see it? The lag between the lie and the paperwork isn't a bug. It is the psyop. A false story only has to hold long enough to get the policy through. After that, the correction can arrive whenever it likes, because the resolution, the invasion, the agency already exists. Nobody unbuilds them. So where is 9/11 on that clock? Further along than most people think. You don't need a leak, you just need to read what the government's already published. The building the commission forgot. At 5:20 that afternoon, a third skyscraper fell. World Trade Center 7 was 47 stories of steel, a block north of the towers, and no plane touched it. It came down in under 7 seconds, straight down. Steel-framed high-rises had burned far longer and stayed up. One Meridian Plaza in Philadelphia burned for 18 hours in 1991 without collapsing. None had ever collapsed from fire. Then the 9/11 Commission published a 567-page report in 2004 and didn't mention the collapse at all. Not a sentence. The only steel-framed skyscraper in history to be brought down at freefall speeds by office fires on the most scrutinized day in American history, and the official investigation skipped it. NIST finally got to it in 2008, 7 years later. Its draft said the building fell 40% slower than free fall, which mattered because free fall means nothing underneath is resisting. A high school physics teacher named David Chandler measured the video during the comment period and showed that the draft was wrong. NIST's final report conceded the point. Stage 2 gravitational acceleration, or free fall, 2.25 seconds, roughly 8 stories, about 105 feet, during which the government's own model requires every supporting column to have given away at once. NIST called it the first known instance of a tall building brought down primarily by uncontrolled fires. Did they test the steel for explosives? No. Their own FAQ says that the analysis would not necessarily have been conclusive. When an engineer filed a FOIA request in 2009 for the computer model that produced the collapse animation, NIST refused on the grounds that releasing the data might jeopardize public safety, a collapse model of a building that no longer exists. The steel that was examined told its own story. FEMA's 2002 report, Appendix C, describes a sample from Building 7 eaten through by high-temperature corrosion due to a combination of oxidification and sulfidation, a reaction near 1,000 degrees Celsius. Quote, "The severe corrosion and subsequent erosion of samples 1 and 2 are very unusual events," the engineers wrote, and, quote, "no clear explanation for the source of the sulfur has been identified," end quote. The New York Times called it perhaps the deepest mystery uncovered in the investigation. NIST never explained it either. In 2020, a 4-year University of Alaska Fairbanks study concluded that fire did not cause the collapse of World Trade Center 7 on 9/11, and that what happened was, quote, "the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building." The changing story. Then there's the morning itself. NORAD gave the commission 3 different timelines for its response. Its co-chairs, Thomas Keene and Lee Hamilton, later wrote that they were set up to fail, And Keene said of the military's testimony, quote, "It was just so far from the truth." The commission secretly debated referring the Pentagon and FAA to the Justice Department for criminal investigation. Its senior counsel, John Farmer, the man who ran the investigation into that morning, put it flatly in his 2009 book, quote, "At some level of the government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened." The NORAD tapes explain part of why. At 8:37 a.m., when Boston Center called the air defense sector about a hijacking, the first words from the sergeant who answered were, "Is this real world or exercise?" Because there were live air defense exercises running that morning, one of several that happened to be rehearsing the exact threat that happened to be actually happening. The mission crew commander's first thought, in his words, were, "Somebody started the exercise early." And the investigation that produced all this? The White House resisted an independent investigation for most of the year, agreed to one 442 days after the attack, and gave it an initial budget of just $3 million. It eventually got about 15. The Columbia shuttle investigation got $50 million. None of that is a theory, it's the record, and the record is still moving. The UK Supreme Court hears Campbell versus Attorney General on October 14th and 15th, a family's five-year fight to reopen the inquest into Jeff Campbell's death in the North Tower after the government refused because 9/11 had, quote, already had been fully investigated. Senator Ron Johnson says he wants hearings on Building 7, and Ted Walter's team is drafting a 1,000-page 9/11 Truth and Accountability report for his subcommittee. Walter walked through it with Corbett on September 2nd and on Grand Theft World this week. 35 years for Northwoods, 41 for Tonkin, 25 and counting for this. Who benefits? Then prove it. The habit needed discipline, and two people gave it to me. Corbett followed the money instead of the physics, because money leaves receipts. On September 10, 2001, Donald Rumsfeld announced the Pentagon couldn't account for $2.3 trillion in transactions. It was the top story for just one day, for obvious reasons. Larry Silverstein signed a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center on July 24th of 2001, insured it for $3.55 billion, and eventually collected roughly $4.55 billion after litigating whether the two planes were one event or two. Put options on United and American spiked in the days before. A 2006 study in the Journal of Business found the pattern consistent with informed investors having traded options in advance of the attacks. And the SEC, after reviewing 9.5 million transactions, said it had, quote, not developed any evidence suggesting that those who had advanced knowledge of the September 11th attacks traded on the basis of that information. Read that sentence again. It isn't a denial that anyone knew in advance. It takes for granted that people had advanced knowledge and argues only that they didn't trade on it. The government's own August 6, 2001 President's Daily Brief was titled, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." Foreknowledge was never the question. The question is who had it, how specific was it, and why the people writing the official sentences keep conceding it in the subordinate clause. Grove's story is smaller and more human. Before Grand Theft World, he sold software to Marsha McLennan, which occupied floors 93 through 100 of the North Tower. By his account, he'd flagged roughly $10 million in suspicious billing on a project inside Marsh as a whistleblower. The people he'd been working with on it were among the 295 Marsh employees who were killed that morning. And he was supposed to be there, but was late to the meeting because of traffic. His whole project since has been one question. When institutions fail this badly, who inside them benefited and why does nobody ask? That's a Murray Rothbard question, almost word for word. In April 1977, he published a short essay on reason called "The Conspiracy Theory of History Revisited." Anyone who offers a, quote, hard-nosed analysis of who our rulers are, of how their political and economic interests interlock, he wrote, is invariably denounced as a conspiracy theorist. Then he gave the method, quote, "The conspiracy theorist asks himself the question of cui bono, who benefits from this measure? And if he finds that measure A benefits X and Y, his next step is to investigate the hypothesis. Did X and Y in fact lobby or exert pressure for the passage of measure A?" from the question to the anarchist. Apply the method to the whole quarter century instead of one morning. Who benefited? Not the 2,977 dead, not the responders now dying of cancer after being told the air was safe, not you in your socks at the airport. Institutions benefited. The Patriot Act passed 45 days after the attacks, largely unread. Then Homeland Security, the TSA, the surveillance Snowden exposed, 2 decades of war, a defense budget that never came down. Randolph Bourne wrote in 1918 that, quote, war is the health of the state. Every PSYOP above ended with the state bigger than it started. Failure was rewarded. It always is. They know it too. In 2004, a senior Bush advisor, widely believed to be Karl Rove, told the journalist Ron Suskind, quote, we're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously, as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities which you can study too, and that's how things will sort out. We are history's actors, and you, all of you, will be left to study what we do. End quote. Read that next to the declassification dates. Northwoods, Tonkin, Building 7. That isn't a boast, it's the operating manual. So somewhere in the early 2010s, watching the man I'd voted for run the same wars with better vocabulary, I'd arrived without quite meaning to at anarchism. Not the black bloc version that you often see represented, the Rothbard version, an institution with a monopoly on violence and a documented habit of lying about when it uses it shouldn't be trusted with either. The problem was that it made me angry and gave me nowhere to put that anger. You can't vote against Northwoods. I'd tried voting against the wars and gotten more wars. For a few years, I was the guy at the party you didn't want to get stuck with. Some of you are nodding to that, and some of you are that guy right now. Keep listening. The peaceful exit. The way out came from asking Rothbard's question about the mechanism instead of the motive. How does a government pay for a PSYOP and the war it sells? It prints. Inflation is the tax that never needs a vote, and a state that never needs a vote never needs your consent. You don't have to agree with a word I said about Building 7 to follow me here. You can accept the official account in full and still not want your savings in the currency that paid for Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria, Yemen, now Iran. If you're against the wars, you're already against the money. Bitcoin can't be printed to fund something you weren't told about. Its supply is public, verifiable, and unchangeable by any chairman, senator, or general. Northwoods was, trust us, bro, we'll tell you in 35 years. Bitcoin is, here's the ledger, check it yourself. And it's peaceful, you don't overthrow anything. You stop holding the thing they print and start holding the thing they can't. It doesn't throw a brick, it just declines. Just one caveat. Leave that Bitcoin on an exchange and you've rebuilt the trust relationship you were escaping. The keys to your Bitcoin are the exit, where the rabbit hole came out. Turning the Tide runs through Sunday. Free live stream at turningthetide911.org. Jason Burmis had the opening slot yesterday. 18 years ago, his film knocked me off the official story and into a decade of asking who benefits. I didn't end up where he probably expected. I ended up holding my own keys and helping other people do the same at a company that has never once held a customer's coins. Strange place for a rabbit hole to come out, but it's the only exit I found that didn't require anyone else to change their minds first. I still want answers about 9/11. I also want less of my life tied to the money that pays for the wars that I marched against. I don't have to finish the first before starting the second. Not your keys, not your coins, and if you can't verify the facts yourself, it was never your truth to begin with.